very great pleasure to introduce to you John Cameron, who is the former director of our meteorological office, the Office of Challenge of Global Warming. Carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year, burning fossil fuels.
deforestation brings an excellent carbon dioxide, and there's also chlorine in that carbon body. And carbon dioxide has been growing rapidly since the Industrial Revolution. This comes from the forest summary of the fourth assessment report of the IPCC, which was published in February. And you can see carbon dioxide was well steady in the atmosphere for a long time before the Industrial Revolution shot up and it came into the sea and it grew rather rapidly. Very, very rapid rate of change indeed. The temperature over the 20th century is shown there, as opposed to the average sea level, and the temperature is going up more rapidly at the end of the century than any other time. And there is very strong evidence that most of that rise, if not indeed all of it, is due to the increase in greenhouse gases. Climate, however, is very variable, as you will know, and there have been many variations in climate, and there's lots of debate over just what the causes of all that kind of variability would be. We have a good handle on most of it, but there is no doubt at all, essentially, that greenhouse gases, the increase in carbon dioxide, is indeed has caused a big increase in temperature, and it's also causing accelerated rates of sea level rise. So what's going to happen this winter? This comes from the IPCC report again. It shows you the temperature during the, this is the global average temperature during the 20th century in black on the left. And it shows the various scenarios of what's likely to happen this century with different assumptions about the amount of carbon dioxide being emitted and other greenhouse gases being emitted by humans over this century. I won't go into all the scenarios except to point out to you that the bottom one, incidentally, is assumed that the carbon dioxide cap is turned off and the climate is close to the century, still warmed up with it. You can see that the average temperature during the century, by the end of the century, is going to be 2-3-4 degrees warmer than it is at the moment. Now you may say, well, what's 2-3 degrees? 2-3 degrees would be rather nice actually to have a cold day. The temperature in this vegetation has probably gone up by a couple of degrees since we all came into it, at least because of our body. So what's 2-3 degrees? Well, this is a global average, let me remind you. And the difference in global average temperature between the middle of an ice age, when this part of the world would have been under ice, and the warm periods in between, and we're in a warm period at the moment, is only 5 or 6 degrees in terms of global average. So 2 or 3 degrees is half an ice age in terms of climate change. And that's enormous. And we're not talking about that happening in over thousands of years, as on the whole it happens during the ice ages. So we're talking about it happening within 100 years. And that is the fastest rate of change of climate in the global surface for 10,000 years. And it's that rate of change which is going to be very hard for both humans and ecosystems to adapt to. I've mentioned ice ages. It's actually so low, ice ages are a big thing. Are we heading to another ice age? We know that what triggers ice ages is the variations in the Earth talking about the sun, which is the lower end of the sun, which is the lower end of the sun. Which causes differences, particularly in the radiation of solar emissions. The next ice age we can forecast in the future very well, so astronomers have very precise information. The next ice age is due in about 50,000 years past, which is even beyond the fact that the horizons are most quality. It's all very well talking about global average temperature. What can I do to that in terms which have more surely impact on global affairs? Just want to talk very briefly about sea level rise, more intense heat waves, and a more intense hydrological cycle. First of all, sea level rise. Because of the warming of ocean water, because the earth is warming, the ocean water is expanding. In the 21st century, the top part of the ocean will warm. After that, the bottom lower part of the ocean will warm. So we're committing at the moment to the order of half degree, half a meter per century, due to warming of the ocean water and due to It may be more than that, because of the notice of the aspects I mentioned up here. But supposing we have the order of Martin Luther of the 6th century, that's what's been called the Great Problem Day of Edinburgh. We were called the large problems in the East of England, where a lot of low-lying land is concerned. We were called the large problems in Florida, where in due course a lot of Florida will disappear. So that was in Bangladesh. Those are the 1 to 5 million households in Bangladesh. You've got 10 million people living below the one with the nearest 1 meter consort. Where do those people go? They're farmers. Because they take all the silk across down to the rivers. Very good agricultural land. They put up with floods and various kinds of loans because the storm goes into the river. But where do they go before the end of this century? There are 35 million people in Southern China. There are many hundreds, if not thousands, of islands in the Indian and Pacific Oceans that are going to disappear. I met a man from Papua New Guinea, only a couple of weeks ago, who's telling me of a small island just by him, where people have lived for hundreds of years, and a small population of less than 1,000 people. And they're part of the low-lying land around the highest part of the island. That land is now disappeared. They can't farm anymore. They can't get their food anymore. How do they live? Food is being shipped to them. They want to go somewhere else, but no other country will have it. Big problem for great people in the world. We see them a lot. Heat weather. In 2003, there was a heat wave in York. It was 20,000 people at least, many people say 35,000 people died. It's not so good. It's not good enough. It was an extremely rare event. The average temperature in June, July, and August, that's 3 months average temperature shown to the middle of Switzerland by all those who last there against the temperature scale on board. It's not a bad distribution, as I said, for typical climatological parameters. 2003, there's 5 standard deviations away from the normal. That's enormous. You do conventional return period analysis on it, which you which is one of the students do when you watch something like that. You find it 1,000 meters, millions or millions of years, depending on how it is. And the scientists are convinced that most of the statistics of that event was because of the increase in greenhouse gases. It's a very, it just couldn't, it was so way outside the range of natural availability. They also point out that by the middle of the century, that's likely to be an average year, and by the end of the century, it would be a cool year. What about water in our global warm world? I showed that picture because that's the Nile flowing through the Sudan. The Nile is a shared river. And it's often said, it was said by the Vice President General of the UN, that there's going to get wars about water, and we're having wars about water, at least little ones, and that's a very recent thing. The red area there, this is a false colour, it gives the space, is irrigated land, and they were growing crops, and that's plain, you're growing crops in the desert because you can irrigate. But water is becoming an increasingly scarce, sparse resource in many parts of the world. And tell you much more about that, but I'm sure you all know that. What's going to happen to our Earth waters? You get more evaporation in general, more water vapor in the atmosphere, more average rainfall around the world, and that's occurring to be a but then there's something else about water vapor that's important. Water vapor is condensed to form clouds. A lot of latency is in that latency is the largest single source of energy from the atmosphere circulation. So you've got increased energy in the atmosphere circulation, increased energy in the hydrological cycle, and that translates into more floods and more clouds. This is changing the precipitation of energy in the summer, or northern summer. During this is projected patterns, I suppose, and not the last patterns, these are projected patterns in the next stage of the participation, and you will see some big changes there. A lot more than before at higher latitudes. Much drier in yours in particular, southern yours, southern United States, southern Africa, and Australia, but wetter in quite some other places too. So big changes in water availability as a result of climate change. Floods and droughts are the most damaging disasters we know. They cause more misery, more economic loss, more deaths than any other disaster on average. That just gives you some idea of the impact of those disasters over the last 25 years or so. What's going to happen this century? There have been a few quite good studies now in the literature on some models, climate models, which have been tested carefully over close climate, about how floods are going to increase by the end of this century, or when carbon dioxide is likely to double from its pre-industrial value. The guess is that the estimates are that floods will increase by something like that, the risk of floods will go up by something like so a 20-year flood will come every 4 years, and a 50-year flood every 10 years and so on. And if you do some southern England recently, you will know what 100-year flood is like. And that happens a lot, but it's not very good news. It's even worse news, of course, because we're in the part of the world, where they've got coping very well. The most frightening statistic I know is the second one on that slide, about floods. A recent work that I have attempted, and that's not written in the UK, is widely agreed to be the best, or one of the best, if not the best, climate model of the world. There's been studying droughts. If you look at droughts today, extreme droughts, defined in rather precise form, the most extreme droughts, at any one time at the moment, cover something like 2% of the world's usable land area. 20 years ago, it was 1%. By 2050, the estimate is that it would be 10 or 12%. Can you imagine how devastating that would be to millions of people living in arid or semi-arid areas for a drought that's going to last in a few months? For 10 to last 2 years. You can cope with them throughout lasting a few months because you get A, you get C for the next crop, the next season, and you can keep going. But if you have a drought lasting 2 years, you have to move. And where do you go to? I put that up there, that's a mix of the North Pole, and it's not lasting for much issue, as far as I know. It's not rising as fast. But I put it there to remind you that polarized and melting rather rapidly. So there's a big concern about Greenland at the moment. And there are 7 meters of sea level rise in Greenland. And its models of Greenland show that if the temperature increases by possibly about 3 degrees, it's getting pretty close to that now. Greenland is like the start to no doubt. By no doubt, we mean that at the moment, the increased snowfall in Little Greenland, again because of climate and global warming, will not manage to keep up with the inflation around the ocean. So, to make the total amount of ice will start to be reduced. So, it's measured that ice in space around the world. Actually, it's measured on the profile of the Greenland and the Antarctic ice. We have a site that is going down at the moment. It's going to go down a little more rapidly than it was. And pictures of what's happening on Greenland are quite amusing, because they worry about it's going to happen very fast indeed, because of non-linear factors, as the water gets below the ice and the ice and all that sort of thing. We have no strong evidence that it will happen that fast. But it's likely to happen over 200 years, or 3,000. If it happens over 700 years, that's the least of the century. And to lose Greenland is not a good thing to lose. You know, to be known as a generation that lost Greenland.
with I think would be a bad law in the future.
So there's some of the impacts of climate change. That's right, to summarize. And just look at the bottom line. We're talking of, I said, many millions, it's hundreds of millions, like an environmental refugee by the second half of the century. The world will already have got hundreds of millions more because the population of this country will have to contain somewhere. But here are people who can't live where they are now. Well, I'll get used to that. But what can you tell them and where do they go? I mostly want to now say something about what we do about it. First of all, let me just point out, as you pointed out, what a strongly disturbed report. The Stern report is a report written by the Minister Stern, the indication of the plan on the economics of climate change. It's a very good report, published by CDP, published last December. It is the best summary of the economics of climate change you can find anywhere. He points out that adaptation is going to be essential. We've got to learn to adapt. We've got to not only adapt ourselves, as we have in this country, the flood system, we've got to help other countries, the poorer countries in the world, also to adapt to their situations as well. Okay, how sure are we about it? Let me just mention the intergovernmental panel on climate change. I was privileged to be the chairman of the Standing Assessment and Co-chairman until 1988 for the IPCC report, until 2002. So I oversaw the first three reports. It was a tremendous experience, the collecting of 100 of scientists from around the world, from as many countries as we can find, and as many disciplines as were relevant, to study and to argue about and to debate. And fight about the science of climate change. The 2001 report, I just go to the reports, they're A4 size, they're very thick, they're 1,000 pages long, covering the science, the impacts and the mitigation, and also the synthesis volume. There are many thousands of scientific references to the scientific literature, and try to cover all the literature, try to set it all, and come up with the very best information we could for the world on the subject of climate change. And it was wonderful that on this discipline of science, we were able to do that. And we were able to push down all the vested interests and all the personal agenda that people tend to do for the reason. So, a bit of a summary about what we did. Just read the bottom line there, because in 2005, the Academies of Science of the G8 countries, together with India, China and Brazil, issued a joint statement urging a global response to climate change, urging strong action from that G8 meeting, which was held in Scotland in 2005, and it will also endorse absolutely the international scientific consensus of the IPCC. You could have not had a stronger statement in the world's scientific community, from the world's top scientists, would not have spoken out more strongly, because they don't normally do something. They don't normally publish statements on anything, that one. They won't publish one on population, I think, but they've never, which wasn't a very precise statement, they've never published on that before. They've had close contact, and the world should take note. And they also published a statement before this G8 summit in Berlin, in Germany. Making just rather even stronger message than they're putting back to 2005. What can we do about that, George? In 1992, there was the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. At that time, it was the largest conference ever staged anywhere. All the world's nations appeared and came and had their heads of state or their heads of government service. The framework convention on climate change was formulated in that summit, and it was signed by all the nations of the world, with
still being the first President Bush in the United States.
And that silent convention was ratified unanimously by the United States Senate very soon after. The convention did not, of course, come up with precise statements about exactly what had to be done. They came up with urging statements and targets, as they said, that all countries, all developed countries, to try to keep their, or reduce their emissions to 1990 levels by the year 2000. Very few countries did that. But it did come up with a strong statement about what the objective is, and that the objective is very simple. Is to stop the climate change. In other words, to stabilize the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and therefore to stop the climate change further. And that has to be done in a way that's avoided everything else. What does that mean in terms of carbon dioxide? Now, here's some profiles, or some profiles on the carbon dioxide emissions from now until 2050. The first one was published by the IEA, the International Energy Agency, and then a 450 parts per million stabilization curve for carbon dioxide, which some people feel is too high, but there's a stabilization curve, which is a federal one, but it shows you the sort of thing that has to be done. We're now at 17 trillion tons per annum of carbon dioxide, carbon dioxide in 2004. And we have to go down pretty well from that to very much less than that in 2050, that's how the world. The left-hand scenario shows you the course on which we're heading at the moment, as generated by the IEA. They have an alternative scenario which shows that if everything the nations have said they will do, they do. That's what was come about. But neither of those can come anywhere near stabilizing carbon dioxide. They also have a beyond the alternative policy scenario where they dream about some food that nations might conceal. And even that is what it really requires. We've got to come down fast for that. It's a tough job. And when you, it's a tough job to do anyway. Supposing you're sitting in an international meeting and your job is to try to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in a fair way around the world. Then your slide number one, your picture number one, is that slide. These emissions from countries or groups of countries around the world have been ordered, and the population, or as it was in 2000 actually, is now the higher. Emissions of tons per capita, each one of us is responsible for some of these emissions. We can't avoid it, we're part of the world community. The average American emits 6 tons per annum. The average European about 2.5. The average Chinese is 1. The average Indian about 0.25. The problem is, how do we allow the developing countries to develop? And how do we reduce what we are doing? The model is narrative. Coming from that picture is very strong. We have grown our wealth in the developed world through cheap fossil fuel energy over a couple of centuries. That's why we love it, because we have a lot of cheap energy from possibly coal, oil and gas. We just realize the damage this is causing to the world, and in particular the damage is going to disproportionately cause to poor countries. So there's an urgent imperative for this country to reduce their deficit, reduce our emissions as rapidly as we can, and to assist developing countries to develop themselves. And that was expressed in the climate convention signed by everybody in 1992, where it said, because developed countries are benefiting from it, developed countries should take the lead in combating climate change. And the casualty test. Will it cost a lot of money? Nicholas Stern in his review tried to assess the cost of damage in money terms and also the cost of action. The cost to the world, the cost of damage to the world he estimated it's somewhere between 5-20% reduction in our gross national product in our average consumption per head. The point is, it's probably nearly the plenty. And if you take account of all those things which are, if you can't put in money for it, it's probably much more than that. You've got to be about the discomfort of the business. But it's certainly more than that for many developing countries. The cost of action of reducing our limits in the developed world by 2050, by 60%, whatever it is, by 2050, according to numbers that have been talked about, that's going to cost us to the order of 1% of our gross national product. Now, we've learned about cost of spend a year, most of us, in this particular measure. So we would lose 6 months of economic growth. That's nothing. That's in the north. We spend that sort of money on in this country, we spend it on the VAT crisis, on the foot and mouth crisis, it's approaching that sort of level. And the Iraq war is costing, if it costs to what, $700 billion? It went outside that sort of level. You can do it. You cost, and in fact, the cost to many people will be less than that because all the innovation and the efficiency growth and so on will come out of that. So when people say it will cost a lot, they haven't read the literature, they've just talked to economists who are telling them the things they want to hear. What actions we've taken, I'm not going to go into all this, but many of you know what back it was, just summarise what we think. We've already become much more efficient in our energy generation than we used. We could easily become 50% more efficient. And we would gain substantially by doing this. We've got to learn to sequester carbon in the ground. We can pop the carbon dioxide from coal fired power stations. And China is building 2 gigawatt power stations every 5 days. We can pop that down into the ground. The European Union is working with China on the first demonstration of power stations that kind. And then we've got to develop energy generation, which is possible for all three, and all sorts of ways of doing that. Let me just, first of all, a couple of things on efficiency, We have to be fairly close to Aberdeen, that's all that's here for this one. That's an interrelated issue of Aberdeen. The red buildings are warm buildings, the blue buildings are cold buildings. The red buildings are poorly insulated, they're losing heat to the outside, burning up some energy, and the blue buildings are relatively efficient. Some of the older buildings in the centre of Aberdeen are pretty bad, but look at some of the housing estates on the edge of Aberdeen, which have not been building houses like that in 2005. Because we could make more blue. Every building should be a blue building. If no house is blue. That's another influence. I'm sorry I don't have one in this capital building. So that was about energy and efficiency, and we can all be very efficient. And much more efficient than we are at the moment. A couple of things about energy from a biological way. Loads of energy rather than big energy. We will need some big energy sources for whatever source. But we desperately need to make energy locally produced. The Chinese government is very worried about movement from the rural areas to the city. 50 million people sitting by 2037. Don't imagine. They want to keep people in the country. What better way of keeping them there than producing energy sources? The local energy, the commercial energy sources in the village area. And there's lots of things we can do to make that happen. And there's another local energy source. Urgent action is required. People say, well, why don't we see? Lots of people say that. And that really is sad because we've already built in a lot of climate change we have to see. It takes time for the oceans to warm up. So there's a lot of climate change there that will come whatever we do if we turn the CO2 cap off tomorrow. And may I just make a call to my brothers and sisters in the United States. The United States is an important country, a big country. I've had the delight of working with many of the best private scientists in the world who come from the United States. You have some of the best scientists. You have enormous capability, technical capability, and you'll find to push ahead with that in various ways. And you have enormous influence. At the moment, your emissions are rising as fast as any other country pretty well, apart from maybe China and India. You're still rising at something like 20% more than you had in 1990. And you are possibly, arguably, the biggest emitter of any country in the world. The Chinese are said to have overtaken you, other people say it's taken it longer for the Chinese to make it, because the numbers are not that good. The possibilities of what you can do are enormous. The world is looking for leadership, and particularly from the United States. I was in a meeting a while ago where top Chinese energy expert was talking. And he said, don't you, in the Western world, don't you imagine that we're going to take action now about greenhouse gases? When you take action, we will take action. They follow them. And I'm also standing by Chinese motorbikes down the road in Beijing. I said, why do you have small cars? There's so many of them. You do have small cars, you have big cars. When you have small cars, we will have small cars. We need to take the lead in the world. And the United States must take the lead. The world is looking for that. And it's very sad about the G8 summit in Germany this year. Your president reluctantly agreed that talks should go ahead. But he was quite adamant that no definite targets or numerical things could happen until 2009 when he left office. That is not the sort of leadership that he needs the US to provide. Although I know there's a movement going on in California, even Florida now, and the eastern states are all making their own thing. But you need a big change with your total action. And finally, very quickly, a few points from a Christian point of view. You're going to hear more of that from other people this morning, so I'm just going to summarize a few thoughts of my own in this area, or things that I find very helpful. We need to care for the earth, and stewardship is the main word we use. The steward comes in Luke chapter 12. The rich greedy fool also comes in Luke chapter 12. Giving you all you have to the poor is also in that chapter. And there's a nice bit of ethology at the end of it. Let me commend to you Luke chapter 12 as a piece of part of scripture that you might find very helpful in thinking about the Christian attitude to private care. The other word I'm using a great deal recently is the word share. And again, scripture has a lot about sharing. Sharing with our neighbours, not just next door, but in all those neighbours we know about who need our help. And are we good at that? We're good in our own families, we share with them, in our own communities we're quite good. We share with them in our own national social program, in our nation. We pay taxes so that others can share in our wealth. But internationally, we're very bad at it. Oh, you say we give aid, of course we do. But it's when you add aid and trade together, and the debt problem.